Hello, and welcome to the Word Theater Short Story Podcast, your free weekly access to the best short stories read by great actors. My name is Cedaring Fox. I'm Word Theater's founder and artistic director. Today's offering is a wonderful story called Intervention by author Jill McCorkle. It was performed by the inimitable Leslie Nichol, who is perhaps best known as Downton Abbey's beloved no-nonsense cook, Mrs. Patmore. McCorkle's first two novels were released simultaneously when she was just out of college, and the New York Times called her a born novelist. Since then, she has published five other novels and four collections of short stories. Many of her stories have been selected for Best American Short Stories, as well as the Norton Anthology of Short Fiction. Five of her books have been New York Times notable books, and her novel, Life After Life, was a New York Times bestseller. Did you know that Word Theater runs an annual week-long writer's workshop in France? And it just so happens that this fall, from September 29th to October 6th, 2023, Jill McCorkle will be running it. We have only two spots available, so if you love what you hear today and are interested in joining us, please email admin@wordtheater.org. That's wordtheatre.org. to secure your spot. But first, have a listen to Intervention, a story about family and love. Enjoy.
Intervention. The intervention is not Marilyn's idea, but it might as well be. She is the one who has talked too much, and she has agreed to go along with it, nodding and murmuring and all right into the receiver, while Sid dozes in front of the evening news. They love watching the news. Things are so horrible all over the world that it makes them feel lucky just to be alive. Sid is 65. He is retired. He is disappearing before her very eyes. "Okay, Mom," she jumps with her daughter's voice, which is loud to be heard over the noise at her end of the phone, a house full of children, a television blasting, whines about homework, all those noises you complain about for years, only to wake one day and realize you would sell your soul to go back for another chance to do it right. "Yes, yes," she says. "Is he drinking right now?" Marilyn has never heard the word intervention before. Well, that's before her daughter Sally introduces it and showers her with a pile of literature. Sally's husband has a master's in social work and considers himself an expert on this topic, as well as many others. Most of Sally's sentences begin with, "Rusty says," to the point that Sid long ago made up a little spoof about Rusty says, turning it into a game like Simon says. "Rusty says, put your hands on your head," Sid said for the first time once the newly married couple were out of earshot. "Rusty says, put your head up your ass." Marilyn howled with laughter, just as she always has. Sid has always made her laugh. Usually she laughs longer and harder. A stranger would have assumed that she was the one slinging back the vodka. 20 years earlier, the stranger would have been right. Sally and Rusty have now been married for a dozen years. 3 kids and 2 Volvos and several major vacations that were so educational there couldn't have been any fun behind them. And still, Marilyn and Sid cannot look each other in the eye while Rusty is talking without breaking into giggles like a couple of junior high school students. And Marilyn knows junior high behavior. She taught language arts for many years. She is not shocked when a boy wears the crotch of his pants around his knees. And she knows that Sean Combs has gone from that perfectly normal name to Sean Puffy Combs, to Puff Daddy, to P. Diddy. She knows that the kids make a big circle at dances so that the ones in the centre can do their grinding without getting in trouble. And she has learned that there are many perfectly good words that you cannot use in front of humans who are being powered by hormonal surges. She once asked her class, "How will you ever get ahead?" Only to have them, even the most pristine honour roll girls, collapse in hysterics. Just last year, her final one, she had learned never to ask if they had hooked up with so-and-so, learning quickly that this no longer meant locating a person but having sex. She could not hear the term now without laughing. She told Sid it reminded her of the time two dogs get stuck in the act just outside her classroom window. The children were out of control, especially when the assistant principal stepped out there armed with a garden hose, which didn't faze the lust-crazed dogs in the slightest. When the female, a scrawny shepherd mix, finally took off running, the male, who was quite a bit smaller, was stuck and forced to hop along behind like a jackrabbit. "His fang is stuck," one of the girls yelled and broke out into a dance, prompting others to do the same. "Sounds like me," Sid said that night when they were lying there in the dark. "I'll follow you anywhere." Now, as Sid dozes, she goes and pulls out the envelope of information about family intervention. She never should have told Sally that she had concerns, never should have mentioned that there were times when she watched Sid pull out of the driveway only to catch herself imagining that this could be the last time she ever saw him.
"Why do you think that?"
Sally asks, suddenly attentive and leaning forward in her chair. She never should have told Sally that she had concerns. Up until that minute, Marilyn had felt invisible while Sally rattled on and on about drapes and chairs and her book group and Rusty's accolades.
"Was he physically drunk? Why do you let him drive when he's that way?"
"Well, he's never visibly drunk," Marilyn said, knowing that she had made a terrible mistake. They were at the mall, one of those forced outings that Sally had read was important. Probably an article Rusty read first called something like, "Spend time with your parents so you won't feel guilty when you slap them in a urine-smelling old folks' home." Rusty's parents are already in such a place. They share a room and eat three meals on room trays while they watch television all day. Rusty says they're ecstatic. They have so much to tell that they are living for the next time Rusty and Sally and the kids come to visit.
"I pray to God I never have to rely on such," Sid said when she relayed this bit of conversation.
She didn't tell him the other parts of the conversation at the mall, how even when she tried to turn the topic to shoes and how it seemed to her that either shoes had gotten smaller or girls had gotten bigger, 9 was the average size for most of her willowy eighth grade girls, Sally bit into the subject like a pit bull.
"How much does he drink in a day?"
Sally asked. "You must know. I mean, you are the one who takes out the garbage and does the shopping." "Well, he helps me."
"A fifth?"
"Sid loves to go to the Harris Teeter. They have a book section and everything."
"Rusty has seen this coming for years."
Sally leaned forward and gripped Marilyn's arm. Sally's hands were perfectly manicured with pale pink nails and a great big diamond.
"He asked me if Dad had a problem before we even got married." She gripped tighter. "Do you know that? That's a dozen years."
"I wonder if the Oriental folks have caused this change in the shoe sizes." Marilyn pulled away and glanced over at Lady Footlocker as if to make a point. She knows that Oriental is not the thing to say. She knows to say Asian. And though Sally thinks that she and Rusty are the ones who teach her all of these things, the truth is that she learned it all from her students. She knew to say Hispanic and then Latino, probably before Rusty did, because she sometimes watches MTV channel so that she'd be up on what is happening in the world and thus in the lives of the children at the junior high. Shocking things, yes, but also important. Sid has always believed that it is better to be educated, even if what is true makes you uncomfortable or depressed. Truth is, she can understand why some of these youngsters want to say motherfucker this and that all the time. Where are their mamas after all? And their daddies? Rusty needs to watch MTV. And Survivor and all the other reality shows, he's got children. And unless he completely rubs off on them, they will be normal enough to want to know what's happening out there in the world. Asian, Sally whispered. You really need to just throw out the word Oriental unless you're talking about lamps and carpets. And I know what you're doing too. What about queer? I hear that word's okay again. You have to deal with Dad's problems, Sally said. I hear even the Homo sapiens use that word, but it might be the kind of thing that only one who is a member can use. Kind of like, will you stop it? Sally interrupted and banged her hand on the table. Like the N-word, Marilyn said. The black children in my class used it, but it would have been terrible for somebody else too. Sally didn't even enunciate African-American the way she usually does. Whoop, this doesn't work anymore. Sally's face reddened, her voice a harsh whisper. So cut the Grace Allen routine. Oh, I loved Gracie. So did Sid. What a woman. Marilyn rummaged her purse for a tissue or a stick of gum, anything so as not to have to look at Sally. Sally looked so much like Sid, they could be in a genetics textbook. Those pouty lips and hard blue eyes, prominent cheekbones and dark curly hair. Sid always told people his mother was a Cherokee and his father was a Jew, which made him a Cherojew. Which Marilyn said sounded like Theraflu, which they both like even when they don't have colds, so he went with Duokey instead. Now, Marilyn's ancestors were all Irish, so she and Sid called their children the Duoke Irish. Sid said that nobody could pronounce the resulting tried name. It would have to be a symbol like the name of the artist formerly known as Prince. Which was something she had just learned and had to explain to Sid. She doubts that Sally and Rusty even know who Prince is, or Nelly, for that matter. Nelly is the reason all the kids are wearing band-aids on their faces, which is great for those who are just learning to shave. Do you remember that whole routine Dad and I made up about ancestry? Marilyn asked. She was able to look up now, Sally's hands squeezing her own, Rusty's hands on her shoulder. If she had an ounce of energy left in her body, she would have run into Lord and Taylor and gotten lost in the mirrored cosmetics section. The fact that you brought all this up is a cry for help, whether you admit it or not, Sally said. And we are here, Mother. We are here for you. She wanted to ask, why mother? What happened to mom and mama and mommy? But she couldn't say a word. There are some nights when Sid is dozing that she feels frightened. She puts her hand on his chest to feel his heart. She puts her cheek close to his mouth to feel his breath. She did the same to Sally and Tom when they were children. Well, it was especially with Tom because he came first. She was up and down all night long in those first weeks, making sure that he was breathing, still amazed that this perfect little creature belonged to them. Sometimes Sid would wake and do it for her, even though his work as a grocery distributor in those days caused him to get up at 5 a.m. The times he went to check, he would return to their tiny bedroom and lunge to order with a perfect Dr. Frankenstein imitation. He's alive! Followed by maniacal laughter. In those days, she joined him for a drink just as the sun was setting. It was their favorite time of day, and they both always resisted the need to flip on a light and return to life. The ritual continued for years and does to this day. When the children were older, they would make jokes about their parents who were always in the dark. And yet those pauses, the punctuation marks of a marriage, could tell their whole history, spoken and unspoken. The literature says that an intervention is the most loving and powerful thing a loved one can do. That some family members might be apprehensive. Tom was apprehensive at first, but he always has been. Tom is the non-combative child. He's an orthopedist living in Denver. Skiing is great for his health and his business and his love life. He met the new wife when she fractured her ankle. Her marriage was already fractured, his broken, much to the disappointment of Marilyn and Sid, who found the first wife to be the most loving and open-minded of the bunch. The new wife, Sid says, is too young to have any opinions you give a damn about. In private, they call her Snow Bunny. Tom was apprehensive until the night he called after the hour she had told everyone was acceptable. Don't call after 9 unless it's an emergency, she had told them. We like to watch our shows without interruption. But that night, while Sid dozed and the made-for-TV movie she had looked forward to ended up, as her students would say, sucking, she went to run a deep hot bath, and that's where she was, incapable of getting to the phone fast enough. Let the machine get it, honey, she called as she dashed with just a towel wrapped around her dripping body. But she wasn't fast enough. She could hear the slur in Sid's speech. He could not say slalom to save his soul. And instead of letting the moment pass, he kept trying and trying. What the shit is wrong with my tongue, Tom? Did I have a goddamn stroke? Slalom. Slalom. Marilyn ran and picked up the extension. Honey, Daddy has taken some decongestants, bless his heart, full of a terrible cold. Go on back to sleep now, Sid. I got it. I haven't got a goddamn cold. Your mother's a kook, he laughed, and waved to her where she stood in the kitchen, a puddle of suds and water at her feet. She's a good-looking naked kook. I can see her bony ass right now. Hang up, Tommy, she said. I'll call you right back from the other phone. Daddy is right in the middle of his program. Yeah, right, Tom said. By the time she got Sid settled down, dried herself off and put on her robe, Tom's line was busy. And she knew before even dialing Sally that hers would be busy too. It was a full hour later when she finally got through, and then it was to a more serious Tom than she had heard in years. Not since he left the first wife and signed off on the lives of her grandchildren in a way that prevented her from seeing them for more than once a year if she was lucky. She could get mad at him for that. So could Sid. We're not talking about my life right now, he said. I've given Dad the benefit of the doubt for years, but Sally and Rusty are right. Rusty? You are the one who said he was full of it, she screamed. And now you're on his side? I'm on your side, Mom, your side. She let her end fall silent and concentrated on Sid's breath. He's alive. Sid likes to drive, and Marilyn has always felt secure with him there behind the wheel. Every family vacation, every weekend gathering, he was always voted the best driver of the bunch, even when a whole group had gathered down at the beach for a summer cookout, where both men and women drank too much. Sid mostly drank beer in those days. He kept an old Pepsi Cola cooler he once won throwing baseballs at tin cans at the county fair, iced down with Falstaff and Schlitz. They still have that cooler. It's out in the garage on the top shelf, long ago replaced with the little red and white playmates. Tom gave Sid his first playmate, which has remained a family joke until this day. And Marilyn drank then. She liked the taste of beer, but not the bloat. She loved to water ski, and they took turns behind a friend's powerboat. The men made jokes when the women dove in to cool off. They claimed that warm spots emerged wherever the women had been, and if they couldn't hold the beer any better than that, they should switch to girl drinks. And so they did. A little wine or a Mai Tai, vodka martinis. Sid had a book that told them how to make everything, and Marilyn enjoyed buying little coloured toothpicks and umbrellas to dress things up when it was their turn to host. She loved rubbing her body with baby oil and iodine and letting the warmth of the sun and salty air soak in while the radio played and the other women talked. They all smoked cigarettes then. They all had little leather cases with fancy lighters tucked inside. Whenever Marilyn sees the Pepsi cooler, she's reminded of those days just married. No worries about skin cancer or lung cancer. No one had varicose veins. No one talked about cholesterol. None of their friends were addicted to anything other than the sun and the desire to get up on one ski to slalom. The summer she was pregnant with Tom, compliments of a few too many Mai Tais, Sid told the group. She sat on the dock and sipped her ginger ale. The motion of the boat made her queasy, as did anything to do with poultry. It ain't the size of the ship, but the motion of the ocean, Sid was fond of saying in those days, and she laughed every time. Every time he said it, she complimented his liner and the power of his steam. They batted words like throttle and wake back and forth like a birdie until finally, at the end of the afternoon, she'd go over and whisper, "Ready to dock." Her love for Sid then was overwhelming. His hair was thick and he tanned a deep, smooth olive without any coaxing. He was everything she had ever wanted. And she told him this those summer days as they sat through the twilight time. She didn't tell him how she sometimes craved the vodka tonics she had missed. Even though many of her friends continued drinking and smoking through their pregnancies, she would allow herself only one glass of wine with dinner. When she bragged about this during Sally's first pregnancy, she expected to be congratulated for her modest intake. Sally was horrified. "My God, Mother," she said, "Tom is lucky there's not something bad wrong with him." Tom set the date for the intervention. As hard as it was for Rusty to relinquish his power, even for a minute, as leader of the posse, it made perfect sense given that Tom had to take time off from his practice and fly all the way from Denver. Snow Bunny was coming too, even though she really didn't know Sid at all. Sometimes, over the past 5 years, Marilyn had called up the first wife just to hear the voice, or even better, the voice of one or more of her grandchildren on the answering machine. Now there was a man's name included in the list of who wasn't home. She and Sid would hold the receiver between them, both with watering eyes when they heard the voices they barely recognized. They didn't know about Star 69 until a few months ago, when Margot, the oldest child, named for Sid's mother, called back. "Who is this?" she asked. She was growing up in Minnesota and now had an accent that Marilyn only knew from Betty White's character on The Golden Girls. "Your grandmother, honey. Grandma Marilyn in South Carolina." There was a long silence, and then the child began to speak rapidly, filling them in on all that was going on in her life. "Mom says you used to teach junior high," Margot said. And she and Sid both grinned. Somehow, having always trusted that their daughter-in-law would not have turned on them, as Tom had led them to believe. Then Susan got on the phone, and as soon as she did, Marilyn burst into tears. "Oh, Susie, forgive me," she said. "You know how much we love you and the kids." "I know," she said. "And if Tom doesn't bring the kids to you, I will, I promise." Marilyn and Sid still believe her. They fantasize during the twilight hour that she will drive up one day and there they'll all be. Then lo and behold, here will come Tom. "He'll see what a goddamn fool he's been," Sid says. "They'll hug and kiss and send Snow Bunny packing." And we'll all live happily ever after, Marilyn says.
You can take that to the bank, baby, he says.
And she hugs him close, whispers that he has to eat dinner before they can go anywhere. You know, I'm a very good driver, she says. And he just shakes his head back and forth. He can list every ticket and fender bender she has had in her life. The intervention day is next week. Tom and Bunny plan to stay with Sally and Rusty an hour away so Sid won't get suspicious. Already it is unbearable to her, this secret. There has only been one time in their whole marriage when she had a secret, and it was a disaster. What is wrong with you? Sid keeps asking. So quiet. His eyes have that somber look she catches once in a while. It's a look of hurt, a look of disillusionment. It is the look that nearly killed them 30-odd years ago. There have been many phone calls late at night. Rusty knows how to set up conference calls, and there they all are, Tom and Sally and Rusty, talking non-stop. If he resists, we do that. If he gets angry, we do that. All the while, Sid dozes. Sometimes the car is parked crooked in the drive, a way that he would never have parked even 2 years ago. And she goes out in her house coat and bedroom slippers to straighten it up, so the neighbours won't think anything's wrong. She has repositioned the mailbox many times, touched up paint on the car and the garage that Sid didn't even notice. Sometimes he is too tired to move or to undress, and she spreads a blanket over him in the chair. And recently she found a stash of empty bottles in the bottom of his golf bag. Empty bottles in the Pepsi cooler and the trunk of his car. I suspect he lies to you about how much he has, Rusty says. We are taught not to ask an alcoholic how much he drinks, but to phrase it in a way that accepts a lot of intake, such as, how many fifths do you go through in a weekend? Sid doesn't lie to me. This is as much for you, Rusty says, and she can hear the impatience in his voice. You are what we call an enabler. She doesn't respond. She reaches and takes Sid's warm, limp hand in her own. If you really love him, he pauses, gathering volume and force in his words, you have to go through with this. It was really your idea, Sally says. We all suspected as much, but you're the one who really blew the whistle. Marilyn remains quiet, picturing herself like some kind of Nazi woman blowing a shrill whistle, dogs barking, flesh tearing. She can't answer. Her head is swimming. Admit it. He almost killed you when he went off the road. It's your side that would have smashed into the pole. You were lucky. I was driving, she says now, whispering so as not to wake him. I almost killed him. Nobody believed you, Marilyn, Rusty says. She is reminded of the one and only student she has hated in her career. A smart-ass boy who spoke to her as if he were the adult and she were the child. Even though she knew better, knew that he was a little jerk, it had still bothered her. You're lucky Mr. Randolph was the officer on duty, Mom, Tom says. He's not going to look the other way next time. He told me as much.
And how about how you told me you had to hide his keys sometimes? Sally says. What about that?
Where are the children? Marilyn asks. Are they hearing all of this?
No, Rusty says. We won't tell this sort of thing until they're older and can learn from it.
We didn't, she whispers, and then ignores their questions. Didn't what? Didn't what? The literature says that there should be a professional involved, she says, and for a brief, anxious moment, relishes their silence. Rusty is a professional, Sally says. This is what he does for a living. Well, Sid lives for a living, she wanted to say, but she let it go. They were coming, come hell or high water. She can't stop what she has put into motion. A rush of betrayal and shame pushing her back to a dark place she has not seen in years. Sid stirs and brings her hand up to his cheek. Sid never told the children anything. He never brought up anything once it had passed, unlike Marilyn, who sometimes gets stuck in a groove, spinning and spinning deeper and deeper. Whenever anything in life, the approach of spring, the smell of gin, pine sap thawing and coming back to life prompts her terrible memory, she cringes and feels the urge to crawl back into a dark hole. She doesn't recognize that woman. That woman was sick, a sick, foolish woman, a woman who had no idea that the best of life was in her hand. It was late spring, and they went with a group to the lake. They hired babysitters round the clock so the men could fish and the women could sun and shop, and nobody had to be concerned for the needs of the youngsters. The days began with coffee and Bloody Marys and ended with sloppy kisses on the sleeping brows of their babies. Sid was worried then. He was bucking for promotions right and left, taking extra shifts. He wanted to run the whole delivery service in their part of the state and knew that he could do it if he ever got the chance to prove himself. Then he would have normal hours, good benefits. Marilyn had never even noticed Paula Edwards' husband before that week. Oh, she spoke to him, yes. She thought it was Paula's good fortune to have married someone who had been so successful, so young. Easy when it's a family business and handed to you, Sid said. The only negative thing she ever heard him say about that man. But there he was. Not terribly attractive, but very attentive. Paula was pregnant with twins and forced to a lot of bed rest. Even now, the words of the situation playing through Marilyn's mind shock her. You needed attention, Sid said, when it all exploded in her face. I'm sorry I wasn't there. Who are you, Jesus Christ? She screamed. Don't you hate me? Paula hates me. I'm not Paula, and I'm not Jesus Christ. He went to the cabinet and mixed a big bourbon and water. He had never had a drink that early in the day. I am a man who is very upset. At me. At both of us. She wanted him to hate her right then. She wanted him to make her suffer, make her pay. She had wanted him. Even at the time, it was Paula's husband meeting her in the weeks following in dark, out-of-the-way parking lots, rest areas out on the interstate, run-down motels no one with any self-esteem would venture into. And yet, there she had been. She bought the new underwear the way women so often do, as if that thin bit of silk could prolong the masquerade. Then later, afterwards, she had burned all the new garments in a huge puddle of gasoline, a flame so high that the fire department came, only to find her stretched out on the grass of her front yard, sobbing. Her children, ages 4 and 2, were there beside her, wide-eyed and frightened. Mummy, are you sick? She felt those tiny hands pulling and pulling. Mummy, are you sad? Paula's husband wanted sex. She could have been anyone those times he twisted his hands in her thick, long hair, grown the way Sid liked it, and pulled her head down. He wanted her to scream out and tear at him. He liked it that way. Paula wasn't that kind of girl, but he knew that Marilyn was. But you're not, Sid told her, in the many years to follow, the times when self-loathing overtook her body and reduced her to an anguished heap on the floor. You're not that kind. People knew. They had to know. But out of respect for Sid, they never said a word. Paula had twin girls and they moved to California. And to this day, they send a Christmas card with a brag letter, much like the one that Sally and Rusty have begun sending. You know, something like, "We are brilliant and we are rich. Our lives are perfect. Don't you wish yours was as good as ours?" If Sid gets the mail, he tears it up and never says a word. He did the same with the letter that Paula wrote to him when she figured out what was going on. Marilyn never saw that letter. She only heard Sid sobbing from the other side of a closed door. The children vigilant as they waited for him to come out. When his days of silence ended and she tried to talk, he simply put a finger up to her lips. His eyes dark and shadowed in a way that frightened her. He mixed himself a drink and offered her one as they sat and listened with relief to the giggles of the children playing outside. Sid had bought a sandbox and put it over the burn spot right there in the front yard. He said that in the fall, when it was cooler, he'd cover it with sod. He gave up on advancing to the top and settled instead on a budget and all the investments he could do to ensure college educations and decent retirement. Her feelings each and every year when spring came had nothing to do with any lingering feelings she might have had about the affair. She had none. Rather, her feelings were about the disgust she felt for herself. And the more disgusted she felt, the more she needed some form of self-medication. For her, alcohol was the symptom of the greater problem, and she shuddered with recall of all the nights Sid had to scoop her up from the floor and carry her to bed. The times she left pots burning on the stove, the time Tom, as a five-year-old, sopped towels where she lay sick on the bathroom floor. "Mommy is sick," he told Sid, who stripped and bathed her, put cool sheets around her body, cool cloth to her head. It was the vision of her children standing there and staring at her, their eyes as somber and vacuous as Sid's had been that day he got Paula's letter, that woke her up. "I'm through," she said. "I need help." Sid backed her just as he always had. Rusty would have called him her enabler. He nursed her and loved her. He forgave her and forgave her. "I'm a bad chemistry experiment," she told Sid. Without him, she would not have survived. On the day of the intervention, the kids come in meaning business, but then can't help but lapse into discussion about their own families and how great they all are. "Snow Bunny wants a baby," which makes Sid's laugh, even though Marilyn can tell he suspects that something is amiss. Rusty has been promoted. He is thinking about going back to school to get his degree in psychology. They gather in the living room, Sid in his chair, a coffee cup on the table beside him. She knows there is bourbon in his cup, but would never say a word. She doesn't have to. Sally sweeps by, grabs the cup, and then is in the kitchen sniffing its content. Rusty gives the nod of a man in charge. Sid is staring at all the questions easily read. Why are they here? Did you know they were coming? Why did you keep this from me? She has to look away. She never should have let this happen. She should have found a way to bring Sid around to his own decision the way he had led her. Now she wants to scream at the children that she did this to Sid. She wants to pull out the picture box and say, "This is me back when I was fucking my friend's husband while you were asleep in your beds. And this is me when I drank myself sick so that I could forget what a horrible woman and wife and mother I was. Here is where I passed out on the floor with a pan of hot grease on the stove, and here is where I became so hysterical in the front yard that I almost burned the house down. I ruined the lawn your father worked so hard to grow. I ruined your father. I did this, and he never told you about how horrible I was. He protected me. He saved me."
Well, Sid, Rusty begins, we've come together to be with you because we're concerned about you.
We love you, Daddy, and we're worried.
Mom is worried, Tom says. And as Sid turns to her, Marilyn has to look down. Your drinking has become a problem, and we've come to get help for you.
I'm the drunk, she wants to say. I was here first.
You're worried, honey? Sid says. Well, why haven't you told me? She looks up now, first at Sid and then at Sally and Tom. If you live long enough, your children learn to love you from afar. Their lives are front and center and elsewhere. Your life is only what they can conjure from bits and pieces. They don't know how it all fits together. They don't know all the sacrifices that have been made. We're here at what is called an intervention, Rusty says. Marilyn, Sid grips the arm of his chair. You know this?
No, she says. No, I didn't. I have nothing to do with this.
Marilyn, Rusty rises from his chair, Sally right beside him. It's like the room has split in two and she is given a clear choice. The choice she wishes she had made years ago, and then maybe none of this would ever have happened. We can take care of this on our own, she says. We have taken care of far worse. Such as, Tom asks. She has always wanted to ask him what he remembers from those horrible days. Does he remember finding her there on the floor? Does he remember her wishing to be dead?
Water under the bridge, Sid says. Water under the bridge.
Sid stands, shoulders back. He is still the tallest man in the room. He is the most powerful man.
You kids are great, he says. You're great and you're right.
He goes into the kitchen and he ceremoniously pours what's left of a fifth of bourbon down the sink. He breaks out another fifth, still wrapped with a Christmas ribbon, and pours it down the sink.
Your mother tends to overreact and exaggerate from time to time, but I do love her.
He doesn't look at her, he just keeps pouring.
She doesn't drink, so I won't drink.
She has never had a problem, Sally says, and for a brief second, Marilyn feels Tom's eyes on her.
I used to, Marilyn says.
Oh, yeah. She'd sip a little wine on holidays. Made her feel sick, didn't it, honey?
Sid says. He's opening and closing cabinets. He puts on the tea kettle.
Mother likes tea in the late afternoon, like the British.
As a matter of fact, he continues, still not looking at her, sometimes we pretend we are both British. She nods and watches him pour out some cheap scotch he always offers to cheap friends. He keeps the good stuff way up high behind her mother's silver service.
And we've been writing our own little holiday letter, Mother and I, and we're going to tell every single thing that has gone on this past year, like Sally and Rusty do. Like, I'm going to tell that Mother has a spastic colon and often feels squiddy, as the British might say. And that I had an abscessed tooth that kept draining into my throat, leaving me no choice but to huck and spit throughout the day. But all that aside, kids, the real reason I can't formally go somewhere to dry out for you right now is, one, I have already booked a hotel over in Myrtle Beach for our anniversary, and two, there is nothing about me to dry. By the end of the night, everyone is talking about one more chance. Sid has easily turned the conversation to Rusty and where he plans to apply to school, and to Snow Bunny and her hopes of having a little Tommy. They say things like they are proud of Sid for his effort, but not to be hard on himself if he can't do it on his own. He needs to realize he might have a problem. He needs to be able to say, I have a problem.
So, wonder what stirred all that up, he asks as they watch the children finally drive away. She has yet to make eye contact with him.
I have to say, I'm glad to see them leave.
He turns now and he waits for her to say something. I say, adios, motherfuckers! She cocks her hands this way and that like the rappers do, which makes him laugh. She notices his hand shaking and reaches it to hold in her own. She waits and then she offers to fix him a small drink to calm his nerves. I don't have to have it, you know, he says. Oh, I know that, she says. I also know you saved the good stuff. She mixes a weak one and goes into the living room where he's turned off all but the small electric candle on the piano. Here's to the last drink, he says, as she sits down beside him. He breathes a deep sigh that fills the room. He doesn't ask again if she had anything to do with what happened. He never questions her a second time. He never has. And in the middle of the night, when she reaches her hand over the cool sheets, she will find him there. And when spring comes and the sticky heat disgusts her with pangs of all the failures in her life, he will be there. And when it is time to get in the car and drive to Myrtle Beach or to see the kids, perhaps even to drive all the way to Minnesota to see their grandchildren, she will get in and close the door to the passenger side without a word. She will turn and look at the house that the two of them worked so hard to maintain, and she will note, as she always does, the perfect green grass of the front yard and how Sid fixed it so that there is not a trace of the mess she made. It is their house. It is their life. She will fasten her seatbelt and she will not say a word.
We hope you have enjoyed hearing Leslie Nichols' performance of Intervention by Jill McCorkle. If you'd like to join us at the Writers' Workshop, or if you want to comment on today's story, please send an email to admin@wordtheater.org. If you're not yet receiving our weekly mailings, please be sure to visit wordtheater.org to sign up. And while you're there, check out our upcoming live and streamed events schedule. 2023 marks our 20th anniversary year, and we have wonderful things going on in Los Angeles, New York, London, and France. We're relying on you to tell your friends about Word Theater, and we sincerely hope that you will become a supporting member today if you aren't already. Contributing members, you can easily access filmed versions of our live events for free from the comfort of your own home, right on your members page, and you have priority seating at our in-person events. For more information, go to wordtheater.org/membership. As always, thanks for tuning in to the Word Theater Short Story Podcast. Thank you, Jonathan Sachs, for composing our theme music, and thank you to our podcast editing intern, Jason Lee. This is Cedaring Fox in Los Angeles. Until next week, signing off.